Dr. Terry Mortensen earned his Ph.D. in the history of geology from Coventry University in England. He has studied and lectured on creation and evolution for more than 25 years. In Origin of Species, Was Darwin Right?, Dr. Mortensen takes a close look at the claims made in Darwin's world-changing book. He answers questions such as, what is natural selection? Can mutations be beneficial? Do animals really change from one kind to another? And most importantly, what is the biblical perspective on these topics?
Origin of Species, Was Darwin Right? Well, I'll give you a guess at what the National Geographic said when they asked a similar question on their cover story article in November of 2004. Was Darwin wrong? They made it clear that he was not wrong, that he was right, and they presented the same arguments that they've been presenting for decades. Nothing new there. But it was only a few months later that Discover Magazine joined the chorus and said, testing Darwin, scientists at Michigan State prove evolution works. Now, if you didn't open the magazine to read the article, you'd think science has just overwhelmingly confirmed Darwin's theory. But you open the article and the very first sentence says this, digital organisms, that is those created in a computer program, not real organisms, just digital ones, that breed thousands of times faster than common bacteria are beginning to shed light on some of the biggest unanswered questions of evolution. So I guess they didn't prove it. All they did was shed light on some of the biggest questions. Well, the National Academy of Sciences is the highest scientific body in our country, and they published a book in 1998 that was sent out to science teachers around the country, teaching about evolution and the nature of science. And in this book, they said, there is no debate within the scientific community over whether evolution has occurred, and there is no evidence that evolution has not occurred. I want you to notice two things in that statement. First of all, they say, there is no debate in the scientific community about evolution. What's the implication of that sentence? It is that if you don't believe in evolution, it's proof positive you're not a scientist. Because all scientists agree about evolution. And then the second thing they say is that there's no evidence that evolution has not occurred. Now, for those of you who remember 8th grade English grammar, you will know that that is a double negative. That's not a very strong statement. They could have said there are mountains of evidence that evolution has occurred. But they make the weaker statement, there's no evidence that it hasn't occurred. But they're very dogmatic here. Well, the theory of evolution can be represented by what I like to call the evolution tree of life. In fact, the evolutionists even talk about this. The evolutionists believe that the first living cell evolved, popped into existence by chance from non-living matter. And then over millions of years of reproduction coupled with natural selection and mutation, which we'll talk about a little later, that single-celled creature diversified into all the different plants and animals that we see on the planet today. So everything is descended from a common ancestor. Now, the evolution theory is based on some assumptions. And we call this philosophy or this assumption, naturalism. And there are two main assumptions in naturalism, and this is the philosophy that controls modern science. The first is that nature or matter is all that exists. And the second is that everything can and must be explained by three things: time and chance and the laws of nature. If you have those three things, time and chance and the laws of nature, the evolutionists say you can explain everything in the living world and indeed everything in the universe. But do all scientists believe in evolution? Consider this statement and think who might have said it. The influence of evolutionary theory on fields far removed from biology is one of the most spectacular examples in history of how a highly speculative idea for which there is no really hard scientific evidence can come to fashion the thinking of a whole society and dominate the outlook of an age. The author goes on, ultimately, the Darwinian theory of evolution is no more nor less than the great cosmogenic, what's that word?
Myth
of the 20th century. Now, who said that? Well, many people have imagined that it was said by a very articulate but scientifically ignorant Southern Baptist preacher from Alabama. But actually, it wasn't. It was said by Michael Denton, who at the time of writing his book, Evolution, a Theory on Crisis, in 1985, he was an agnostic. He wasn't sure whether there's a God or not. And in the book, he didn't cite one Bible verse to support his conclusion. Rather, he discussed biological, paleontological, and microbiological evidence to lead him to the conclusion that the Darwinian theory of evolution is a myth. But Michael Denton is not the only scientist who has been raising scientific criticisms of evolution. In the last 40 years, there have been a number of books, and they've been coming at a little faster clip. And you'll notice one thing about the dates of all these. They were published before 1998, when the National Academy of Science, as I just quoted, said there was no debate in the scientific community. Furthermore, these are non-scientists who have been raising scientific criticisms against evolution. Many of these authors are lawyers. Lawyers are highly trained to discern when somebody is manipulating the evidence to lead to a faulty conclusion. They're experts in logic. And they, in these writings, accept the scientific observations that the evolutionists say, but argue they don't add up to support the theory. In addition, there has been in the last 40 years the growth of what we call biblical creationists. And many people think that biblical creationists are only in the United States, but actually they're all over the world. The Answers in Genesis ministry began in Australia in 1978. There's a creation science organization in Russia with PhD members. Korea actually has the largest creation organization in the world with over 2,000 members and many of them with PhDs or university teaching positions. In fact, there was an article back in 2000 in the secular weekly science journal, New Scientist, all about the creation scientists, and they had this map showing that there are over 30 countries of the world that have at least one creation science organization in them. So this is a worldwide movement. Now, just as the evolutionists have some presuppositions from which they build their theory, so do creationists. And those presuppositions come from the Bible. In Genesis chapter 1, we are told that on the third day of creation, God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit after their kind." And that phrase, "after their kind," appears two more times in relationship to the creation of the plants. And then in verse 21, on day 5, the sea creatures were created after their kind, and the birds after their kind. And then on day 6, the beasts of the earth, the cattle, the creeping things were created after their kind. This phrase, "after their kind" or "after its kind," appears in Genesis 1 10 times. And the repetition is emphatic. God is saying that He made different kinds of creatures to reproduce after their kind, not to change from one kind into a different kind. And then there's one more important passage, and that's in Genesis chapter 6, where God tells Noah to take of every living thing two of every kind. And here again we see this phrase, after their kind, repeated three times in verse 20. So from these verses, we can make a model for the creation view of the origin of living things. And that is what I like to call the creation forest of life, in contrast to the evolution tree of life. God created the different kinds of plants and animals distinct. He built into their genetic information potential for variety within the kind, but not the ability to change from one kind into another. And so over the 1600 years leading up to the flood, they did produce variety within their kind. Then God told Noah to take two of every kind of land animal and bird onto the ark. And so he did. He didn't take two of every variety, but two of every kind. And they came off the ark and they multiplied. And in the almost 4,000 years since the flood, they've had more time to diversify into more varieties in the post-flood world. So, which of these views of living things is correct? The evolution tree of life or the creation forest of life? Which view is supported by the scientific evidence? Now, in answering this question, we need to keep in mind two very important questions. One is, how did the DNA information for the supposed first living microscopic creature come into existence? And then secondly, how did the DNA information in that simple creature get changed and augmented to produce all the different kinds of plants and animals that we see in the fossil record and living on the earth today? So to begin with, let's look at the question of the origin of the first living cell. Back in 1953, when I was born, this famous experiment was done in Chicago at the University of Chicago, done by Stanley Miller, a graduate student, with his supervising professor, Harold Urey. And they imagined what the early atmosphere of the Earth was like, and they put the chemicals that they thought were in that atmosphere in some water and heated it and simulated a lightning strike in the atmosphere to see what kinds of chemicals, compounds they could produce. And they produced a lot of tarry, worthless goo, but they did produce a few amino acids, which are the building blocks of life. A lot of people got really excited and thought they were just on the verge of creating life in the test tube, but they were not even close. Another thing they had in this experiment was, you can see at the bottom there, they had a trap. The reason they had this was because they knew that if they allowed the material that they created in the spark to cycle back through the system, the same system that created those compounds would destroy them. So they had to have a trap. Of course, in the primordial ocean of the earth, there was no such trap. So that's kind of cheating. But Stanley Miller has devoted the rest of his scientific career to studying the origin of life, and he has gotten nowhere near the solution. In fact, Paul Davies, who is at the Australian Center for Astrobiology, makes this very telling statement on the origin of the first cell. He is a world-renowned scientist. And he says this: nobody knows how a mixture of lifeless chemicals spontaneously organized themselves into the first living cell. Nobody knows. After 50 years of research, they haven't got a clue. Just today, I read about Harvard University's new origin of life research. They have committed to providing $1 million a year for the next several years to establish an Origins of Life Research Center. And the newspaper report about that quoted one of the scientists at Harvard. He said, "My expectation is that we will be able to reduce this to a very simple series of logical events that could have taken place with no divine intervention." The scientists have been working for 50 years, probably thousands of them. They've already spent hundreds of millions of dollars. And they think they're going to find a solution that is a very simple series of logical steps. They have a lot more faith than I do. But as Paul Davies said, they haven't got a clue how lifeless chemicals evolved into the first living cell. So right here at the beginning, the evolution tree of life is dead. If they can't get the first living cell from non-living matter, that's the end of the theory. But it fits the creation view, that life was created by God supernaturally. But let's suppose just for a moment that somehow that first living cell came into existence by chance. We'll give the evolutionists the benefit of the doubt. Is the rest of the tree of evolution supported by the evidence? And to begin with, in the first part of this lecture, we're going to look at the fossil record. Does the fossil record support the theory of evolution or the model of creation? Now, the Grand Canyon is one of the best places to see the fossil record. 270 miles long, 4 to 18 miles wide, and a mile deep. And when you look at those layers, you can find just on the layers as they're exposed in the Colorado River Valley, evidence of billions and billions of fossils buried in those layers. The evolutionists have tried to recreate what that fossil record looked like. They call it the geological time scale or the geological column. And they picture in this time scale that very simple creatures, so-called, came into existence first. They were down here in the bottom of the rock record, and then they diversified into fish and amphibians and reptiles and eventually into mammals and even into human beings. Now, you need to know that this geological column does not exist anywhere in the real world except in the textbooks and the magazine articles. You cannot drill down into the earth anywhere and find this nice, neat progression of fossils. In fact, we find marine fossils all the way through the geological column. Now, there is a general order, but it's not nearly as nice and tidy as this picture suggests. The evolutionists say that that represents the evolution of life over millions and millions of years. Now, to understand whether the fossil record supports the theory of evolution or not, we need to be very, very clear about the difference between evolution and creation, because the evolutionists are notorious at confusing things. They will often say that evolution is change. Well, evolution is change, but it is a certain kind of change. I'm changing. I don't look exactly the same as I did when I graduated from high school. I have a few less hairs, a few more pounds in different places. But I can guarantee you one thing. I am not evolving. If anything, I'm devolving. I'm going downhill. I'm not going uphill to superhuman. So it's a certain kind of change that evolution has in mind. And I like to call it vertical change. See, the evolutionists believe that the first living cell came into existence by chance, and then it diversified over time by mutations and natural selection into the first fish. And then some of those fish gradually, over millions of years, evolved into the first amphibians. And then those amphibians evolved into reptiles. And some of the reptiles evolved into birds. Some of the reptiles evolved into mammals. And some of the mammals evolved into people. So it's vertical variation from one kind to a completely different kind of creature. The creation model is very different. The creationists say that there is horizontal variation. God created the first single-celled creatures, different kinds of single-celled creatures. He built into their genetic information the potential for variety within their kind, but not the ability to change into some other kind of creature. He created the first kind of fish, distinct, with the genetic potential for producing variety within that kind of fish, but not to change into a different kind of fish or to change into a non-fish. The same with amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals, and people. God supernaturally created the first representative kinds with variety. Potential for variety. So the question is whether the fossil record and later, as we look at living things, support the idea of vertical change from one kind to another or simply horizontal change within the kinds. Here's a chart from a magazine article in 1978 in Scientific American. The whole issue that month was devoted to evolution. And in the chapter on mammal evolution, we had this chart. It shows the different kinds of mammals there at the top, kangaroo and anteater and rabbit and squirrel and gorilla and whales and tigers and camels and horses, etc. The blue bars coming down are showing us how deep down in the fossil record those creatures appear. And then you'll notice that there are some blue dotted lines that connect some of these blue bars to creatures that they don't know what look like, some creatures that they have an idea, and then they're all connected to a common ancestor, which they don't have a name for or a picture of. Now, the question is, does the fossil record support the dotted blue lines? And I call as my expert witness on this question Dr. Stephen Jay Gould. Until his death in 2002, he was probably America's most famous evolutionist. He was an atheist Jew, and he hated creationists, but he was one of the most honest evolutionists. He was a professor of geology and paleontology at Harvard, and he said this about the fossil record. The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. I want you to notice two things in that statement. First of all, he tells us that we only have data at the tips and the nodes of the branches. We don't have fossil evidence, he says, for the branches themselves. And then he says, this fact is the trade secret of paleontology. In other words, either all the paleontologists know this and have kept it a secret from the rest of us in society, or only the elite paleontologists like Stephen Gould, who have access to the huge museums, know this, and the low-level junior college paleontologists don't know this. But it's a trade secret, and he says the transitional forms are extremely rare. That is, if evolution is true, you ought to be able to find fossils of 90% reptile, 10% bird, 80% reptile, 20% bird, 70% reptile, 30% bird, 50% reptile, 50% bird, and so on. But he says this is extremely rare. In fact, the evolutionists can only point to a handful of very controversial fossils. So let's draw that diagram from Scientific American the way Stephen Gould says the evidence really is. You'll notice that I erased all the dotted blue lines. That's because Dr. Gould said we don't really have fossil evidence for those dotted blue lines. And then I did one other thing. I changed the bottom ends of those blue bars. I took away the little bend. Why? Because the blue bars don't exist in the fossil record. They only exist on this page of the magazine. It's the fossil creatures that are in the rock record. And as far as they go down, when they find a kangaroo, it looks like a kangaroo. It doesn't look like a part kangaroo. As far as they go down, they see a camel. It's a camel, not a part camel. Now, that to me does not look like the evolution tree of life. It looks a lot like the creation forest of life. And Gould goes on in the article that I quoted to say that the two characteristics of the fossil record are abrupt appearance and stasis. That is, that the first time we see a creature appearing in the lowest rock formation that we find it, it appears fully formed, fully functional, fully recognizable. It just abruptly appears. And then as we come up through the rock records, as long as we see that creature, it basically stays the same. Oh, a little bit of variety, but it's basically the same creature. There's lots of evidence of this. They're called living fossils. One example is the Wollemi pine. For many, many years, the evolutionists said that the Wollemi pine was a tree that went extinct 150 million years ago. Until in 1994, west of Sydney, Australia, they found the Wollemi pine growing. And when they compared the Wollemi pine branches and leaves with the fossil, they were virtually identical. Hadn't changed in 150 million years of supposed evolution. The coelacanth was said by the evolutionists to be a fish that died out about 65 million years ago, along with the dinosaurs, because that was the highest level in the rock record that they found the coelacanth, until 1938, when they found the coelacanth swimming off the coast of Madagascar in deep water. And they've since found it in fishing villages in Indonesia and Japan. And when they compare the living coelacanth with the fossil coelacanth, it's virtually identical. The creature hasn't changed in 65 million years of supposed evolution. There's lots more examples of that. There's what the living creature looks like. Here's an article recently in 2003 about salamanders found fossilized in China. And they said these salamanders have extraordinary morphological similarity to their living relatives. That's a very technical way of saying they look just like the salamanders living today. And they say they've changed little over 160 million years. Army ants have been around 100 million years, the evolutionists say, but they haven't changed. They look just like the living ones. Plesiosaurs have changed little during their 135 million years of evolution. In the lowest rock record where we find a plesiosaur, they look essentially the same as the highest rock record where we find plesiosaurs. They found sea turtles fossilized in rock layers that they said were 100 million years old, but they said they're virtually unchanged compared to sea turtles today. And then here's a really big one. Blue-green algae, the oldest living fossils, dated in rock layers to be 3.5 billion years old, and they are identical to blue-green algae living today. These critters haven't changed at all in 3.5 billion years. Now, I mentioned that the evolutionists do have some fossil evidence that they put forth for evolution. It's rare, but here's one of the evidences. Phil Gingrich, writing in the Journal for Geological Education, a journal for science teachers, he had this picture of this creature that looked like a transitional form between a land animal and a whale. Evolutionists believe that whales evolved from land animals. And you can see that it is on its way to becoming a whale. Its rear end is definitely moving in that direction. It's already on a fish diet. The front legs are still land animal, though. What was the fossil evidence for Phil Gingrich to have his artist draw this? Well, he tells us it was the head. No, it was not the head. It was just the stippled parts of the skull. He had no fossil evidence at this time below the neck. Now, I don't know about you, but I find it difficult to see how you can take that piece of bone and that piece of bone and then tell me what the front legs looked like and what the rear end looked like. But Phil Gingrich said about this creature, which he called Pakicetus, which means whale from Pakistan, which is where the fossil was found, in time and in its morphology, Pakicetus is perfectly intermediate, a missing link between earlier land mammals and later full-fledged whales. Well, now, that article was written in 1994, but they found some more fossils after 1994. And in a technical article in the British journal Nature, which is the world's leading English-language technical science journal, there was an article in 2001 about Pakicetus and all the fossil evidence they had found since 1994. And this was the evidence. Looks a lot like a whale to me, doesn't it? And by our study of anatomy, the scientists can guess pretty well what this creature looked like when it was alive. And they said these were terrestrial mammals, that is, land-based mammals, no more amphibious than a tapir, kind of like a pig. I don't know if you've been down to the ocean side recently, but I haven't seen any pigs swimming in the ocean recently. So this is a case of misinterpreted fossil evidence, jumping to conclusions on the basis of very skimpy evidence. And the evolutionists in the last 100 years have done this over and over again. But that's not the end of the story. A couple of months ago, I was hunting around on the website, and I went to the University of Berkeley, California website. They have a whole website devoted to evolution and all the evidence for evolution. And they have evidence from living things, and they have fossil evidence. And I clicked on the icon for fossil evidence, and they had two pieces of evidence for horse evolution and whale evolution. And I was developing this talk at that time, and I thought, well, this ought to be interesting. I think I'll see what they have to say about whale evolution. So I clicked on the icon and came to this page. And it had a picture on the left of this creature with its nostril near the tip of its nose, Pakicetus, dated 50 million years ago. And then this creature over here, beluga whale, with the nostrils up here at the top of the skull. Well, obviously, if that Pakicetus evolved into a whale, then you've got to move that hole for the nose. But listen, there's more to making a sea creature out of a land animal than just moving the hole. I'll give you a simple scientific experiment. You can go home tonight, put clay up your nostrils here, and then get your electric drill and put two holes up there. See if you breathe just as well. No, don't do that. I don't want any lawsuits. So it's not just a matter of moving the holes. But then it says transitional form. So I clicked on that icon, and up popped this picture. And lo and behold, the nostrils are in the middle of the skull, and the skull is dated at 25 million years. I mean, that's perfect. That is a transitional form. You creationists, what more do you want? This is a proof of evolution. Well, I said, okay, I know what Pachycetus is, but beluga whales, I'm not an expert on whales, so I had to go on the web and hunt around a little bit. That's what a beluga whale looks like. But now, Itiocetus, I wonder what that is. They didn't have any information right there at that place on the Berkeley website, so I hunted around a little bit, found out that Itiocetus was called somewhere else on the web, on the Berkeley website and also on another website about whales, that it was the earliest baleen whale. Well, what's a baleen whale? Well, I got a picture of a baleen whale. Now, a baleen whale does not have teeth. They have baleen. It's a sieve system. They open their mouth, take in a big gulp of water and all kinds of food, and then they let the water run out through the sieve and keep the food in their mouth. That's a completely different system from this Itiocetus. But there's another thing about baleen whales. They are anywhere from 2 to 40 times bigger than a beluga whale. This is not a transitional form between that and that. This is a 100% fully operational whale like that one is, and this is not suited for living in the water. Now, I can only come to one of two conclusions. Either the University of California, Berkeley scientists who put this website together are grossly ignorant about Pachycetus, beluga whales, and baleen whales, or they are deliberately deceiving the public. And I find it hard to believe that they could be that ignorant. I think this is a classic case of deception, of deliberately deceiving the public. The vast majority of people who will visit that website will never do the exploration that I did to check what was going on. So, does the fossil record support evolution or creation? Well, it doesn't support evolution, but it does consistently fit with creation. The fossil record does not support the evolution of Tree of Life, but it fits exactly with what we would expect from the creation forest of life. God made distinct kinds of creatures. We wouldn't expect to see them changing into different kinds of creatures in the fossil record, and in fact, we do not. Well, what about the study of living creatures? We're going to look at that in the second part of this lecture, but I want to introduce it by just looking at one of the very famous proofs of evolution. How many of you have seen this diagram? It appears in a lot of the scientific textbooks. It is from Ernst Haeckel's book in 1877. He was the leading German evolutionist at that time, and he presented a theory called embryonic recapitulation, that the embryo rehearses its evolutionary history as it develops, and that all mammals have the same kind of embryonic development. And he gave as proof of this these pictures. You have the pig, the cow, the rabbit, and the human. And just look at the same stage of development. They're virtually identical. So this is just proof positive that the theory of evolution is true. The only problem is these pictures were a fraud. They were known to be a fraud by German medical doctors at the time, but they went into the evolution textbooks. Let me show you that they're a fraud. Here are Haeckel's drawings of a fish, salamander, turtle, chicken, rabbit, human. Now I'm going to show you the actual photographs of these creatures, and I'll admit that they look pretty close to Haeckel's drawings, but if you look carefully, you can see a difference. Here they are. Don't they look just like Haeckel's drawings? Here's some more creatures. They don't look anything like Haeckel's drawings. He was deliberately deceiving his readers. But that's not the end of the story. Those pictures still appear in our textbooks today. Here is a high school biology textbook. We have this in our Answers in Genesis library, used here in the United States. And there are Haeckel's drawings right up at the top. I've looked at the book, read everything around the picture. There's not a hint that those pictures are fraudulent. Here's a book by Ernst Mayr. He was the greatest evolutionist after Stephen Jay Gould. He died at the age of 100 just a year ago. And in his book, What Evolution Is, which was written for the general public, in the chapter, What is the Evidence for Evolution? Here we have Haeckel's drawings. I have the book in my library. And there's nothing in the discussion around this picture that would let Mayr's readers know that these are fraudulent pictures. So, conclusions for this first part of our discussion of Darwin's theory. First, the evolutionists have no idea how the first living creature came into existence by chance. Secondly, they have no indisputable fossil evidence that one kind of creature evolved into a different kind of creature. They just have a handful of highly debatable examples, and sometimes fraudulent examples. In the second part of our lecture, we're going to look at living creatures to see whether they support the theory of evolution or creation. Stay tuned.